run. He understood. If Bob wouldn't protect them, their only chance was to run. But that wasn't any chance at all.
Bob, listen, he tried again. The Arai want you to get angry. They spawn from bitter thoughts. Don't give them what they want. We are your friends.
Even as he said it, Percy felt like a liar. He'd left Bob in the underworld and hadn't given him a thought since. What made them friends? The fact that Percy needed him now? Percy always hated it when the gods used him for their errands. Now, Percy was treating Bob the same way.
You see his face? The Arai growled. The boy cannot even convince himself. Did he visit you after he stole your memory?
No, Bob murmured. His lower lip quivered. The other one did. Percy's thoughts moved sluggishly.
The other one?
Nico! Bob scowled at him, his eyes full of hurt. Nico visited. Told me about Percy. Said Percy was good. Said he was a friend. That is why Bob helped.
But...
Percy's voice disintegrated like someone had hit it with a celestial bronze blade. He'd never felt so low and dishonorable, so unworthy of having a friend. The Arai attacked, and this time, Bob did not stop them. Chapter 30. Percy.
Left!
Percy dragged Annabeth, slicing through the Arai to clear a path. He probably brought down a dozen curses on himself, but he didn't feel them right away, so he kept running. The pain in his chest flared with every step. He wove between the trees, leading Annabeth at a full sprint, despite her blindness. Percy realized how much she trusted him to get her out of this. He couldn't let her down. Yet, how could he save her? And if she was permanently blind? No. He suppressed a surge of panic. He would figure out how to cure her later. First, they had to escape. Leathery wings beat the air above them. Angry hissing and the scuttling of clawed feet told him the demons were at their backs. As they ran past one of the black trees, he slashed his sword across the trunk. He heard it topple, followed by the satisfying crunch of several dozen Arai as they were smashed flat. If a tree falls in the forest and crushes a demon, does the tree get cursed? Percy slashed down another trunk, then another. It bought them a few seconds, but not enough. Suddenly, the darkness in front of them became thicker. Percy realized what it meant just in time. He grabbed Annabeth right before they both would have charged off the side of the cliff.
What? She cried. What is it?
Cliff, he gasped. Big cliff.
Which way then?
Percy couldn't see how far the cliff dropped. It could be 10 feet or 1,000. There was no telling what was at the bottom. They could jump and hope for the best, but he doubted the best ever happened in Tartarus. So, two options, right or left, following the edge. He was about to choose randomly when a winged demon descended in front of him, hovering over the void on her bat wings, just out of sword reach.
Did you have a nice walk?
Asked the collective voice, echoing all around them. Percy turned. The Arai poured out of the woods, making a crescent around them. One grabbed Annabeth's arm. Annabeth wailed in rage, judo flipping the monster and dropping on its neck, putting her whole body weight into an elbow strike that would have made any pro wrestler proud. The demon dissolved, but when Annabeth got to her feet, she looked stunned and afraid as well as blind.
Percy?
She called, panic creeping into her voice.
I'm right here.
He tried to put his hand on her shoulder, but she wasn't standing where he thought. He tried again, only to find she was several feet farther away. It was like trying to grab something in a tank of water, with the light shifting the image away.
Percy!
Annabeth's voice cracked.
Why did you leave me?
I didn't.
He turned on the Arai, his arms shaking with anger.
What did you do to her?
We did nothing, the demons said. Your beloved has unleashed a special curse, a bitter thought from someone you abandoned. You punished an innocent soul by leaving her in her solitude. Now, her most hateful wish has come to pass. Annabeth feels her despair. She, too, will perish alone and abandoned.
Percy?
Annabeth spread her arms, trying to find him. The Arai backed up, letting her stumble blindly through their ranks.
Who did I abandon? Percy demanded. I never...
Suddenly, his stomach felt like it had dropped off the cliff. The words rang in his head. An innocent soul, alone and abandoned. He remembered an island, a cave lit with soft glowing crystals, a dinner table on the beach, tended by invisible air spirits.
She wouldn't, he mumbled. She'd never curse me.
The eyes of the demons blurred together like their voices. Percy's sides throbbed. The pain in his chest was worse, as if someone were slowly twisting a dagger. Annabeth wandered among the demons, desperately calling his name. Percy longed to run to her, but he knew the Arai wouldn't allow it. The only reason they hadn't killed her yet was that they were enjoying her misery. Percy clenched his jaw. He didn't care how many curses he suffered. He had to keep these leathery old hags focused on him and protect Annabeth as long as he could. He yelled in fury and attacked them all. Chapter 31. Percy. For one exciting minute, Percy felt like he was winning. Riptide cut through the Arai as though they were made of powdered sugar. One panicked and ran face first into a tree. Another screeched and tried to fly away, but Percy sliced off her wings and sent her spiraling into the chasm. Each time a demon disintegrated, Percy felt a heavier sense of dread as another curse settled on him. Some were harsh and painful, a stabbing in the gut, a burning sensation like he was being hosed down with a blowtorch. Some were subtle, a chill in the blood, an uncontrollable tick in his right eye. Seriously, who curses you with their dying breath and says, "I hope your eye twitches"? Percy knew that he'd killed a lot of monsters, but he'd never really thought about it from the monster's point of view. Now, all their pain and anger and bitterness poured over him, sapping his strength. The Arai just kept coming. For every one he cut down, six more seemed to appear. His sword arm grew tired. His body ached, and his vision blurred. He tried to make his way toward Annabeth, but she was just out of reach, calling his name as she wandered among the demons. As Percy blundered toward her, a demon pounced and sank its teeth into his thigh. Percy roared. He sliced the demon to dust, but immediately fell to his knees. His mouth burned worse than when he had swallowed the fire water of the Phlegethon. He doubled over, shuddering and retching, as a dozen fiery snakes seemed to work their way down his esophagus.
"You have chosen," said the voice of the Arai, "the curse of Phineas, an excellent, painful death."
Percy tried to speak. His tongue felt like it was being microwaved. He remembered the old blind king who had chased harpies through Portland with a weed whacker. Percy had challenged him to a contest, and the loser had drunk a deadly vial of Gorgon's blood. Percy didn't remember the old blind man muttering a final curse. But as Phineas dissolved and returned to the underworld, he probably hadn't wished Percy a long and happy life. After Percy's victory then, Gia had warned him.
"Do not press your luck. When your death comes, I promise it will be much more painful than Gorgon's blood."
Now he was in Tartarus, dying from Gorgon's blood plus a dozen other agonizing curses, while he watched his girlfriend stumble around, helpless and blind, and believing he'd abandoned her. He clutched his sword. His knuckles started to steam. White smoke curled off his forearms. "I won't die like this," he thought. Not only because it was painful and insultingly lame, but because Annabeth needed him. Once he was dead, the demons would turn their attention to her. He couldn't leave her alone. The Arai clustered around him, snickering and hissing.
"His head will erupt first," the voice speculated.
"No,"
the voice answered itself from another direction.
"He will combust all at once."
They were placing bets on how he would die, what sort of scorch mark he would leave on the ground.
"Bob," he croaked. "I need you."
A hopeless plea. He could barely hear himself. Why should Bob answer his call twice? The Titan knew the truth now. Percy was no friend. He raised his eyes one last time. His surroundings seemed to flicker. The sky boiled and the ground blistered. Percy realized that what he saw of Tartarus was only a watered-down version of its true horror, only what his demigod brain could handle. The worst of it was veiled, the same way the mist veiled monsters from mortal sight. Now, as Percy died, he began to see the truth. The air was the breath of Tartarus. All these monsters were just blood cells circulating through his body. Everything Percy saw was a dream in the mind of the dark god of the pit. This must have been the way Nico had seen Tartarus, and it had almost destroyed his sanity. Nico, one of the many people Percy hadn't treated well enough. He and Annabeth had only made it this far through Tartarus because Nico D'Angelo had behaved like Bob's true friend.
"You see the horror of the pit?"
the Arai said soothingly.
"Give up, Percy Jackson. Isn't death better than enduring this place?"
"I'm sorry," Percy murmured.
"He apologizes," the Arai shrieked with delight. "He regrets his failed life, his crimes against the children of Tartarus."
"No," Percy said. "I'm sorry, Bob. I should have been honest with you. Please, forgive me. Protect Annabeth."
He didn't expect Bob to hear him or care, but it felt right to clear his conscience. He couldn't blame anyone else for his troubles. Not the gods, not Bob. He couldn't even blame Calypso, the girl he'd left alone on that island. Maybe she'd turned bitter and cursed Percy's girlfriend out of despair. Still, Percy should have followed up with Calypso, made sure the gods sprang her from her exile on Ogygia, like they'd promised. He hadn't treated her any better than he'd treated Bob. He hadn't even thought much about her, though her moon-lace plant still bloomed in his mom's window box. It took all his remaining effort, but he got to his feet. Steam rose from his whole body. His legs shook. His insides churned like a volcano. At least Percy could go out fighting. He raised Riptide. But before he could strike, all the Arai in front of him exploded into dust. Chapter 32. Percy. Bob seriously knew how to use a broom. He slashed back and forth, destroying the demons one after the other, while Small Bob, the kitten, sat on his shoulder, arching its back and hissing. In a matter of seconds, the Arai were gone. Most had been vaporized. The smart ones had flown off into the darkness, shrieking in terror. Percy wanted to thank the Titan, but his voice wouldn't work. His legs buckled. His ears rang. Through a red glow of pain, he saw Annabeth a few yards away, wandering blindly toward the edge of the cliff.
"Ugh,"
Percy grunted. Bob followed his gaze. He bounded toward Annabeth and scooped her up. She yelled and kicked, pummeling Bob's gut, but Bob didn't seem to care. He carried her over to Percy and put her down gently. The Titan touched her forehead. "Owie." Annabeth stopped fighting. Her eyes cleared.
"Where? What?"
She saw Percy, and a series of expressions flashed across her face. Relief, joy, shock, horror.
"What's wrong with him?" she cried. "What happened?"
She cradled his shoulders and wept into his scalp. Percy wanted to tell her it was okay, but of course it wasn't. He couldn't even feel his body anymore. His consciousness was like a small helium balloon, loosely tied to the top of his head. It had no weight, no strength. It just kept expanding, getting lighter and lighter. He knew that soon it would either burst or the string would break, and his life would float away. Annabeth took his face in her hands. She kissed him and tried to wipe the dust and sweat from his eyes. Bob loomed over them, his broom planted like a flag. His face was unreadable, luminously white in the dark.
"Lots of curses," Bob said. "Percy has done bad things to monsters."
"Can you fix him?" Annabeth pleaded. "Like you did with my blindness. Fix Percy."
Bob frowned. He picked at the name tag on his uniform like it was a scab. Annabeth tried again.
"Bob."
"Iapetus," Bob said, his voice a low rumble. "Before Bob, it was Iapetus."
The air was absolutely still. Percy felt helpless, barely connected to the world.
"I like Bob better."
Annabeth's voice was surprisingly calm.
"Which do you like?"
The Titan regarded her with his pure silver eyes.
"I do not know anymore."
He crouched next to her and studied Percy. Bob's face looked haggard and careworn, as if he suddenly felt the weight of all his centuries.
"I promised," he murmured. "Nico asked me to help. I do not think Iapetus or Bob likes breaking promises."
He touched Percy's forehead.
"Owie,"
the Titan murmured.
"Very big owie."
Percy sank back into his body. The ringing in his ears faded. His vision cleared. He still felt like he had swallowed a deep fryer. His insides bubbled. He could sense that the poison had only been slowed, not removed. But he was alive. He tried to meet Bob's eyes to express his gratitude. His head lolled against his chest.
"Bob cannot cure this," Bob said. "Too much poison. Too many curses piled up."
Annabeth hugged Percy's shoulders. He wanted to say, "I can feel that now. Ow, too tight."
"What can we do, Bob?" Annabeth asked. "Is there water anywhere? Water might heal him."
"No water," Bob said. "Tartarus is bad."
"I noticed," Percy wanted to yell. At least the Titan called himself Bob. Even if he blamed Percy for taking his memory, maybe he would help Annabeth if Percy didn't make it.
"No," Annabeth insisted. "No, there has to be a way, something to heal him."
Bob placed his hand on Percy's chest. A cold tingle like eucalyptus oil spread across his sternum, but as soon as Bob lifted his hand, the relief stopped. Percy's lungs felt as hot as lava again.
"Tartarus kills demigods," Bob said. "It heals monsters, but you do not belong. Tartarus will not heal Percy. The pit hates your kind."
"I don't care," Annabeth said. "Even here, there has to be some place he can rest, some kind of cure he can take. Maybe back at the altar of Hermes, or..."
In the distance, a deep voice bellowed. A voice that Percy recognized, unfortunately.
"I smell him," roared the giant. "Beware, son of Poseidon. I come for you."
"Polybetes," Bob said. "He hates Poseidon and his children. He is very close now."
Annabeth struggled to get Percy to his feet. He hated making her work so hard, but he felt like a sack of billiard balls. Even with Annabeth supporting almost all his weight, he could barely stand.
"Bob, I'm going on, with or without you," she said. "Will you help?"
The kitten, small Bob, mewed and began to purr, rubbing against Bob's chin. Bob looked at Percy, and Percy wished he could read the Titan's expression. Was he angry or just thoughtful? Was he planning revenge, or was he just feeling hurt because Percy had lied about being his friend?
"There is one place," Bob said at last. "There is a giant who might know what to do."
Annabeth almost dropped Percy.
"A giant? Bob, giants are bad."
"One is good," Bob insisted. "Trust me, and I will take you, unless Polybetes and the others catch us first."
Chapter 33. Jason. Jason fell asleep on the job, which was bad, since he was 1,000 feet in the air. He should have known better. It was the morning after their encounter with Skyron the bandit, and Jason was on duty, fighting some wild Venti who were threatening the ship. When he slashed through the last one, he forgot to hold his breath. A stupid mistake. When a wind spirit disintegrates, it creates a vacuum. Unless you're holding your breath, the air gets sucked right out of your lungs. The pressure in your inner ear drops so fast, you black out. That's what happened to Jason. Even worse, he instantly plunged into a dream. In the back of his subconscious, he thought, "Really? Now?" He needed to wake up, or he would die, but he wasn't able to hold on to that thought. In the dream, he found himself on the roof of a tall building. The nighttime skyline of Manhattan spread around him. A cold wind whipped through his clothes. A few blocks away, clouds gathered above the Empire State Building, the entrance to Mount Olympus itself. Lightning flashed. The air was metallic with the smell of oncoming rain. The top of the skyscraper was lit up as usual, but the lights seemed to be malfunctioning. They flickered from purple to orange, as if the colors were fighting for dominance. On the roof of Jason's building stood his old comrades from Camp Jupiter, an array of demigods in combat armor, their imperial gold weapons and shields glinting in the dark. He saw Dakota and Nathan, Layla and Marcus. Octavian stood to one side, thin and pale, his eyes red-rimmed from sleeplessness or anger, a string of sacrificial stuffed animals around his waist. His augur's white robe was draped over a purple t-shirt and cargo pants. In the center of the line stood Reyna, her metal dogs, Aurum and Argentum, at her side. Upon seeing her, Jason felt an incredible pang of guilt. He'd let her believe they had a future together. He had never been in love with her, and he hadn't led her on, exactly. But he also hadn't shut her down. He disappeared, leaving her to run the camp on her own. Okay, that hadn't exactly been Jason's idea, but still. Then he had returned to Camp Jupiter with his new girlfriend Piper and a whole bunch of Greek friends in a warship. They'd fired on the Forum and run away, leaving Reyna with a war on her hands. In his dream, she looked tired. Others might not notice, but he'd worked with her long enough to recognize the weariness in her eyes, the tightness in her shoulders, under the straps of her armor. Her dark hair was wet, like she'd taken a hasty shower. The Romans stared at the roof access door as if they were waiting for someone. When the door opened, two people emerged. One was a faun. No, Jason thought, a satyr. He'd learned the difference at Camp Half-Blood, and Coach Hedge was always correcting him if he made that mistake. Roman fauns tended to hang around and beg and eat. Satyrs were more helpful, more engaged with demigod affairs. Jason didn't think he'd seen this particular satyr before, but he was sure the guy was from the Greek side. No faun would look so purposeful, walking up to an armed group of Romans in the middle of the night. He wore a green Nature Conservancy t-shirt with pictures of endangered whales and tigers and stuff. Nothing covered his shaggy legs and hooves. He had a bushy goatee, curly brown hair tucked into a Rasta-style cap, and a set of reed pipes around his neck. His hands fidgeted with the hem of his shirt, but considering the way he studied the Romans, noting their positions and their weapons, Jason figured this satyr had been in combat before. At his side was a red-headed girl Jason recognized from Camp Half-Blood, their oracle, Rachel Elizabeth Dare. She had long, frizzy hair, a plain white blouse, and jeans covered with hand-drawn ink designs. She held a blue plastic hairbrush that she tapped nervously against her thigh like a good luck talisman. Jason remembered her at the campfire, reciting lines of prophecy that sent Jason, Piper, and Leo on their first quest together. She was a regular mortal teenager, not a demigod. But for reasons Jason never understood, the spirit of Delphi had chosen her as its host. The real question, what was she doing with the Romans? She stepped forward, her eyes fixed on Reyna.
You got my message.
Octavian snorted.
That's the only reason you made it this far alive, Greekus. I hope you've come to discuss surrender terms.
Octavian,
Reyna warned.
At least search them,
Octavian protested.
No need,
Reyna said, studying Rachel Dare.
Do you bring weapons?
Rachel shrugged.
I hit Kronos in the eye with his hairbrush once. Otherwise, no.
The Romans didn't seem to know what to make of that. The mortal didn't sound like she was kidding.
And your friend?
Reyna nodded to the satyr.
I thought you were coming alone.
This is Grover Underwood, Rachel said. He's a leader of the council.
What council?
Octavian demanded.
Cloven Elders, man!
Grover's voice was high and reedy, as if he were terrified, but Jason suspected the satyr had more steel than he let on.
Seriously, don't you Romans have nature and trees and stuff? I've got some news you need to hear. Plus, I'm a card-carrying protector. I'm here to, you know, protect Rachel.
Reyna looked like she was trying not to smile.
But no weapons?
Just the pipes. Grover's expression became wistful.
Percy always said my cover of Born to be Wild should count as a dangerous weapon, but I don't think it's that bad.
Octavian sneered.
Another friend of Percy Jackson. That's all I need to hear.
Reyna held up her hand for silence.
Her gold and silver dogs sniffed the air, but they remained calm and attentive at her side.
So far, our guests speak the truth, Reyna said. Be warned, Rachel and Grover. If you start to lie, this conversation will not go well for you. Say what you came to say.
From her jeans pocket, Rachel dug out a piece of paper like a napkin.
A message from Annabeth.
Jason wasn't sure he'd heard her right. Annabeth was in Tartarus. She couldn't send anyone a note on a napkin.
Maybe I've hit the water and died, his subconscious said. This isn't a real vision. It's some sort of after-death hallucination.
But the dream seemed very real. He could feel the wind sweeping across the roof. He could smell the storm. Lightning flickered over the Empire State Building, making the Romans' armor flash.
Reyna took the note.
As she read it, her eyebrows crept higher. Her mouth parted in shock. Finally, she looked up at Rachel.
Is this a joke?
I wish, Rachel said. They're really in Tartarus.
But how?
I don't know, Rachel said. The note appeared in the sacrificial fire at our dining pavilion. That's Annabeth's handwriting. She asks for you by name.
Octavian stirred.
Tartarus? What do you mean?
Reyna handed him the letter. Octavian muttered as he read.
Rome, Arachne, Athena... Athena Parthenos?
He looked around in outrage, as if waiting for someone to contradict what he was reading.
A Greek trick! Greeks are infamous for their tricks!
Reyna took back the note.
Why ask this of me?
Rachel smiled.
Because Annabeth is wise. She believes you can do this, Reyna Avila Ramirez Arellano.
Jason felt like he'd been slapped. Nobody ever used Reyna's full name. She hated telling anyone what it was. The only time Jason had ever said it aloud, just trying to pronounce it correctly, she'd given him a murderous look.
That was the name of a little girl in San Juan, she told him. I left it behind when I left Puerto Rico.
Reyna scowled.
How did you...
Grover Underwood interrupted.
You mean your initials are Rah-Rah?
Reyna's hand drifted toward her dagger.
But that's not important,
the satyr said quickly.
Look, we wouldn't have risked coming here if we didn't trust Annabeth's instincts. A Roman leader returning the most important Greek statue to Camp Half-Blood? She knows that could prevent a war. This isn't a trick. Rachel added. We're not lying. Ask your dogs.
The metallic greyhounds didn't react. Reyna stroked Aram's head thoughtfully.
The Athena Parthenos. So the legend is true. Reyna!
Octavian cried.
You can't seriously be considering this. Even if the statue still exists, you see what they're doing. We're on the verge of attacking them, destroying the stupid Greeks once and for all. And they concoct this stupid errand to divert your attention. They want to send you to your death.
The other Romans muttered, glaring at their visitors. Jason remembered how persuasive Octavian could be, and he was winning the officers to his side. Rachel Dare faced the augur.
"Octavian, son of Apollo, you should take this more seriously. Even Romans respected your father's oracle of Delphi."
"Ha!" Octavian said. "You're the oracle of Delphi? Right. And I'm the Emperor Nero."
"At least Nero could play music," Grover muttered. Octavian balled his fists. Suddenly, the wind shifted. It swirled around the Romans with a hissing sound, like a nest of snakes. Rachel Dare glowed in a green aura, as if hit by a soft emerald spotlight. Then the wind faded, and the aura was gone. The sneer melted from Octavian's face. The Romans rustled uneasily.
"It's your decision," Rachel said, as if nothing had happened. "I have no specific prophecy to offer you, but I can see glimpses of the future. I see the Athena Parthenos on Half-Blood Hill. I see her bringing it."
She pointed at Rhaena.
"Also, Ella has been murmuring lines from your Sibylline books."
"What?"
Rhaena interrupted.
"The Sibylline books were destroyed centuries ago."
"I knew it!"
Octavian pounded his fist into his palm.
"That harpy they brought back from the quest? Ella? I knew she was spouting prophecies. Now I understand. She somehow memorized a copy of the Sibylline books."
Rhaena shook her head in disbelief.
"How is that possible?"
"We don't know," Rachel admitted. "But yes, that seems to be the case. Ella has a perfect memory. She loves books. Somewhere, somehow, she read your Roman book of prophecies. Now she's the only source for them."
"Your friends lied," Octavian said. "They told us the harpy was just muttering gibberish. They stole her."
Grover huffed indignantly.
"Ella isn't your property. She's a free creature. Besides, she wants to be a Camp Half-Blood. She's dating one of my friends, Tyson."
"The Cyclops," Rhaena remembered. "A harpy dating a Cyclops."
"That's not relevant," Octavian said. "The harpy has valuable Roman prophecies. If the Greeks won't return her, we should take their oracle hostage. Guards?"
Two centurions advanced, their pila leveled. Grover brought his pipes to his lips, played a quick jig, and their spears turned into Christmas trees. The guards dropped them in surprise.
"Enough!"
Rhaena shouted. She didn't often raise her voice. When she did, everyone listened.
"We've strayed from the point," she said. "Rachel Dare, you're telling me Annabeth is in Tartarus, yet she's found a way to send this message. She wants me to bring this statue from the ancient lands to your camp."
Rachel nodded.
"Only a Roman can return it and restore peace." "And why would the Romans want peace?" Rhaena asked. "After your ship attacked our city."
"You know why," Rachel said. "To avoid this war, to reconcile the gods' Greek and Roman sides. We have to work together to defeat Gia."
Octavian stepped forward to speak, but Rhaena shot him a withering look.
"According to Percy Jackson," Rhaena said, "the battle with Gia will be fought in the ancient lands, in Greece."
"That's where the giants are," Rachel agreed. "Whatever magic, whatever ritual the giants are planning to wake the Earth Mother, I sense it will happen in Greece. But, well, our problems aren't limited to the ancient lands. That's why I brought Grover to talk to you."
The satyr tugged his goatee.
"Yeah, see, over the last few months, I've been talking to satyrs and nature spirits across the continent. They're all saying the same thing. Gia is stirring.
I mean, she's right on the edge of consciousness. She's whispering in the minds of naiads, trying to turn them. She's causing earthquakes, uprooting the dryad's trees. Last week alone, she appeared in human form in a dozen different places, scaring the horns off some of my friends. In Colorado, a giant stone fist rose out of a mountain and swatted some party ponies like flies.
Raina frowned.
Party ponies?
Long story, Rachel said. The point is, Gia will rise everywhere. She's already stirring. No place will be safe from the battle. And we know that her first targets are going to be the demigod camps. She wants us destroyed.
Speculation, Octavian said. A distraction. The Greeks fear our attack. They're trying to confuse us. It's the Trojan horse all over again.
Raina twisted the silver ring she always wore with the sword and torch symbols of her mother, Bellona.
Marcus, she said, bring Scipio from the stables.
Raina, no!
Octavian protested. She faced the Greeks.
I will do this for Annabeth, for the hope of peace between our camps. But do not think I have forgotten the insults to Camp Jupiter. Your ship fired on our city. You declared war, not us. Now leave.
Grover stamped his hoof.
Percy would never...
Grover, Rachel said, we should go.
Her tone said, before it's too late. After they had retreated back down the stairs, Octavian wheeled on Raina.
Are you mad?
I am Praetor of the Legion, Raina said. I judge this to be in the best interest of Rome.
To get yourself killed? To break our oldest laws and travel to the ancient lands? How will you even find their ship, assuming you survive the journey?
I will find them, Raina said. If they are sailing for Greece, I know a place Jason will stop. To face the ghosts in the House of Hades, he will need an army. There is only one place where he can find that sort of help.
In Jason's dream, the building seemed to tilt under his feet. He remembered a conversation he'd had with Raina years ago, a promise they had made to each other. He knew what she was talking about.
This is insanity, Octavian muttered. We're already under attack. We must take the offensive. Those hairy dwarfs have been stealing our supplies, sabotaging our scouting parties. You know the Greeks sent them.
Perhaps, Raina said. But you will not launch an attack without my orders. Continue scouting the enemy camp. Secure your positions. Gather all the allies you can. And if you catch those dwarfs, you have my blessing to send them back to Tartarus. But do not attack Camp Half-Blood until I return.
Octavian narrowed his eyes.
While you're gone, the Augur is the senior officer. I will be in charge.
I know. Raina didn't sound happy about it.
But you have my orders. You all heard them.
She scanned the faces of the centurions, daring them to question her. She stormed off, her purple cloak billowing and her dogs at her heels. Once she was gone, Octavian turned to the centurions.
Gather all the senior officers. I want a meeting as soon as Raina has left on her fool's quest. There will be a few changes in the Legion's plans.
One of the centurions opened his mouth to respond, but for some reason he spoke in Piper's voice.
Wake up!
Jason's eyes snapped open, and he saw the ocean's surface hurtling toward him. Chapter 34 Jason. Jason survived. Barely. Later, his friends explained that they hadn't seen him falling from the sky until the last second. There was no time for Frank to turn into an eagle and catch him. No time to formulate a rescue plan. Only Piper's quick thinking and charm speak had saved his life. She'd yelled, "Wake up," with so much force that Jason felt like he'd been hit with defibrillator paddles. With a millisecond to spare, he'd summoned the winds and avoided becoming a floating patch of demigod grease on the surface of the Adriatic. Back on board, he had pulled Leo aside and suggested a course correction. Fortunately, Leo trusted him enough not to ask why. "Weird vacation spot," Leo grinned. "But hey, you're the boss." Now, sitting with his friends in the mess hall, Jason felt so awake, he doubted he would sleep for a week. His hands were jittery. He couldn't stop tapping his feet. He guessed that this was how Leo felt all the time, except that Leo had a sense of humor. After what Jason had seen in his dream, he didn't feel much like joking. While they ate lunch, Jason reported on his mid-air vision. His friends were quiet long enough for Coach Hedge to finish a peanut butter and banana sandwich, along with a ceramic plate. The ship creaked as it sailed through the Adriatic, its remaining oars still out of alignment from the giant turtle attack. Every once in a while, Festus, the figurehead, creaked and squeaked through the speakers, reporting the autopilot status in that weird machine language that only Leo could understand. "A note from Annabeth." Piper shook her head in amazement. "I don't see how that's possible. But if it is..." "She's alive," Leo said. "Thank the gods and pass the hot sauce." Frank frowned.
"What does that mean?"
Leo wiped the chip crumbs off his face.
"It means pass the hot sauce, Jong. I'm still hungry."
Frank slid over a jar of salsa.
"I can't believe Reyna would try to find us. It's taboo, coming to the ancient lands. She'll be stripped of her praetorship."
"If she lives," Hazel said. "It was hard enough for us to make it this far with 7 demigods and a warship."
"And me,"
Coach Hedge belched.
"Don't forget, Cupcake, you got the satyr advantage."
Jason had to smile. Coach Hedge could be pretty ridiculous, but Jason was glad he'd come along. He thought about the satyr he'd seen in his dream, Grover Underwood. He couldn't imagine a satyr more different from Coach Hedge, but they both seemed brave in their own way. It made Jason wonder about the fauns back at Camp Jupiter, whether they could be like that if the Roman demigods expected more from them. Another thing to add to his list. His list. He hadn't realized that he had one until that moment, but ever since leaving Camp Half-Blood, he'd been thinking of ways to make Camp Jupiter more Greek. He had grown up at Camp Jupiter. He'd done well there, but he had always been a little unconventional. He chafed under the rules. He joined the 5th cohort because everyone told him not to. They warned him it was the worst unit, so he'd thought, fine, I'll make it the best. Once he became praetor, he'd campaign to rename the Legion the 1st Legion rather than the 12th Legion, to symbolize a new start for Rome. The idea had almost caused a mutiny. New Rome was all about tradition and legacies. The rules didn't change easily. Jason had learned to live with that and even rose to the top. But now that he had seen both camps, he couldn't shake the feeling that Camp Half-Blood might have taught him more about himself. If he survived this war with Gia and returned to Camp Jupiter as a praetor, could he change things for the better? That was his duty. So why did the idea fill him with dread? He felt guilty about leaving Reyna to rule without him, but still, Part of him wanted to go back to Camp Half-Blood with Piper and Leo. He guessed that that made him a pretty terrible leader.
"Jason?" Leo asked. "Argo-2'd Jason, come in."
He realized his friends were looking at him expectantly. They needed reassurance. Whether or not he made it back to New Rome after the war, Jason had to step up now and act like a praetor.
"Yeah, sorry."
He touched the groove that Skyron the Bandit had cut in his hair. "Crossing the Atlantic is a hard journey, no doubt, but I'd never bet against Reyna. If anyone can make it, she will." Piper circled her spoon through her soup. Jason was still a little nervous about her getting jealous of Reyna, but when she looked up, she gave him a dry smile that seemed more teasing than insecure.
"Well, I'd love to see Reyna again," she said. "But how is she supposed to find us?"
Frank raised his hand.
"Can't you just send her an iris message?"
"They're not working very well," Coach Hedge put in. "Horrible reception. Every night, I swear, I could kick that rainbow goddess."
He faltered. His face turned bright red.
"Coach?" Leo grinned. "Who have you been calling every night, you old goat?"
"No one," Hedge snapped. "Nothing. I just meant..."
"He means we've already tried,"
Hazel intervened, and the coach gave her a grateful look.
"Some magic is interfering. Maybe Gia. Contacting the Romans is even harder. I think they're shielding themselves."
Jason looked from Hazel to the coach, wondering what was going on with the satyr and how Hazel knew about it. Now that Jason thought about it, the coach hadn't mentioned his cloud nymph girlfriend Melly in a long time. Frank drummed his fingers on the table.
"I don't suppose Reyna has a cell phone?" "Nah, never mind. She'd probably have bad reception on a Pegasus flying over the Atlantic."
Jason thought about the Argo II's journey across the ocean, the dozens of encounters that had nearly killed them. Thinking about Reyna making that journey alone, he couldn't decide whether it was terrifying or awe-inspiring.
"She'll find us," he said. "She mentioned something in the dream. She's expecting me to go to a certain place on our way to the House of Hades. I'd forgotten about it, actually, but she's right. It's a place I need to visit."
Piper leaned toward him, her caramel braid falling over her shoulder. Her multicolored eyes made it hard for him to think straight.
"And where is this place?" she asked.
A town called Split."
"Split?"
She smelled really good. Like blooming honeysuckle.
Yeah.
Jason wondered if Piper was working some sort of Aphrodite magic on him, like maybe every time he mentioned Reyna's name, she would befuddle him so much he couldn't think about anything but Piper. He supposed it wasn't the worst sort of revenge.
"In fact, we should be getting close. Leo?"
Leo punched the intercom button.
"How's it going up there, buddy?"
Festus, the figurehead, creaked and steamed.
"He says maybe 10 minutes to the harbor," Leo reported. "Though I still don't get why you want to go to Croatia, especially a town called Split. I mean, you name your city Split? You gotta figure it's a warning to, you know, Split. Kind of like naming your city Get Out."
"Wait," Hazel said. "Why are we going to Croatia?"
Jason noticed that the others were reluctant to meet her eyes. Since her trick with the mist against Skyron the Bandit, even Jason felt a little nervous around her. He knew that wasn't fair to Hazel. It was hard enough being a child of Pluto, but she'd pulled off some serious magic on that cliff. And afterward, according to Hazel, Pluto himself had appeared to her.
That was something Romans typically called a bad omen.
Leo pushed his chips and hot sauce aside.
Well, technically, we've been in Croatian territory for the past day or so. All that coastline we've been sailing past is it. But I guess back in the Roman times, it was called... What'd you say, Jason? Bodacious?
Dalmatia, Nico said,
making Jason jump.
Holy Romulus. Jason wished he could put a bell around Nico D'Angelo's neck to remind him the guy was there. Nico had this disturbing habit of standing silently in the corner, blending into the shadows. He stepped forward, his dark eyes fixed on Jason. Since they'd rescued him from the bronze jar in Rome, Nico had slept very little and eaten even less, as if he were still subsisting on those emergency pomegranate seeds from the underworld. He reminded Jason a little too much of a flesh-eating ghoul he'd once fought in San Bernardino.
Croatia used to be Dalmatia, Nico said, a major Roman province. You want to visit Diocletian's palace, don't you?
Coach Hedge managed another heroic belch.
Whose palace? And is Dalmatia where those Dalmatian dogs come from? That 101 Dalmatians movie.
I still have nightmares.
Frank scratched his head.
Why would you have nightmares about that?
Coach Hedge looked like he was about to launch into a major speech about the evils of cartoon Dalmatians. But Jason decided he didn't want to know.
Nico was right, he said. I need to go to Diocletian's palace. It's where Reyna will go first, because she knows I would go there.
Piper raised an eyebrow.
And why would Reyna think that? Because you've always had a mad fascination with Croatian culture?
Jason stared at his uneaten sandwich. It was hard to talk about his life before Juno wiped his memory. His years at Camp Jupiter seemed made up, like a movie he'd acted in decades before.
Reyna and I used to talk about Diocletian, he said. We both kind of idolized the guy as a leader. We talked about how we'd like to visit Diocletian's palace. Of course, we knew that was impossible. No one could travel to the ancient lands. But still, we made this pact that if we ever did, that's where we'd go.
Diocletian, Leo considered the name, then shook his head. I got nothing. Why was he so important?
Frank looked offended.
He was the last great pagan emperor.
Leo rolled his eyes.
Why am I not surprised you know that, Zhang?
Why wouldn't I? He was the last one who worshipped the Olympian gods before Constantine came along and adopted Christianity.
Hazel nodded.
I remember something about that. The nuns at St. Agnes taught us that Diocletian was a huge villain, right along with Nero and Caligula.
She looked askance at Jason.
Why would you idolize him?
He wasn't a total villain, Jason said. Yeah, he persecuted Christians, but otherwise he was a good ruler. He worked his way up from nothing by joining the Legion. His parents were former slaves, or at least his mom was. Demigods know he was a son of Jupiter, the last demigod to rule Rome. He was also the first emperor ever to retire, like, peacefully, and give up his power. He was from Dalmatia, so he moved back there and built a retirement palace. The town of Split grew up around...
He faltered when he looked at Leo, who was mimicking taking notes with an air pencil.
Go on, Professor Grace, he said, wide-eyed. I want to get an A on the test.
Shut up, Leo.
Piper sipped another spoonful of soup.
So why is Diocletian's palace so special?
Nico leaned over and plucked a grape. Probably that was the guy's entire diet for the day.
It's said to be haunted by the ghost of Diocletian, who was a son of Jupiter.